day two of what I think has been a great occasion, and I'm very much looking forward to part two today. So welcome to session one, which promises to give us the pleasures and the horrors of World War One simultaneously or sequentially in the one session. So I'm not quite sure if this was organised to jolt us into the extremities of the event, but I'm very much looking forward to these two pages. And our two speakers this morning perhaps need not a great deal of introduction, but I'd just like to say a few things about Felicity Barnes and Rod Edmund, who are going to present their research this morning. Felicity is at the University of Auckland and produced a book that, you know, could not be more appropriate to be at the centre of a conference such as this, New Zealand's London, a really wonderful discussion of the way in which London is at the centre of New Zealand, or New Zealand is at the centre of London, or both. And today we're going to be going into the holiday part of that discussion. And Rod Edmund, known to all of us as the organiser of the conference, but of course known to us also for his work over many years in literature and cultural history at the University of Kent, but also as somebody who lives across the New Zealand, England, I was about to say divide, but it's actually the connection, perhaps the bridge that divides and opens. Those of you who haven't read Rod's most recent book, Migrations, Your Life is Missing Something. If you haven't, so I strongly recommend you do so. It's a really wonderful discussion of connections over time and space there. So, Felicity, can we begin with your Zulmassie's tourists in the big smoke where we currently are?
Mm-hmm. And we couldn't... No, I don't need this. Do I? Tell me if I need... And we couldn't be in a more appropriate location in a kind of micro way as well, because though we often associate this area with the literary set, the Bloomsbury set, in World War One, this is the New Zealand soldiers' London. So these streets, particularly the little area from the back of the British Museum through to us, it is a little New Zealand geography during this period of time. So it's even more appropriate. Now, the subtitle of my piece.
Just because there's a little bit of background.
Do you want that? Sure.
That would be nice, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
The subtitle for this paper, which I didn't include for aesthetic reasons, it would obscure too much of the photograph that I'm interested in, is Rethinking War's Role in National Identity. And so what I want to do with the paper today is use the experience of the people that came to be known as Bill Massey's tourists to pick away at some of the legends and myths around war's role in identity. And that's why I wanted to start with this image, which is, after all, an unexpected image of war. Now, it was taken by a young New Zealand soldier, Herbert Huxley Green, who'd joined the Canterbury Infantry in December 1916 at the age of 23. Now, though he could have been conscripted at this time, Herbert Green was, like so many other New Zealanders, still a volunteer. And we could speculate for the reasons about his delay. I don't think, even though he came from Christchurch, he suffered from goitre, so that is probably not the reason. But he was a rationalist, and that may explain perhaps his delay initially and then his decision to volunteer rather than be compelled. And that sort of brought to mind some of the things that Jamie talked about, regional differences in terms of conscription and reasons for getting involved in this war. Now, having joined, like so many other New Zealanders, Herbert Green's war was spent on the Western Front. But this photograph is not of battlefields or trenches or camps, the kinds of images that we regularly collect to commemorate New Zealand's war experience, nor is it an image of war's devastation of the type that Sandy Callister's work on war photography has recently and very graphically revealed. Instead, Green's image captures an almost entirely neglected aspect of New Zealand's Great War. Probably taken, as it happens, on Peace Day in 1919, it reveals the experience of New Zealand soldiers not in Egypt or Gallipoli or on the Western Front, but in another of the Great War's symbolic landscapes, London and Piccadilly Circus, to be exact. Now, the image may be unexpected, but finding a New Zealand soldier in the heart of empire was anything but. Here are a few of them in Petticoat Lane. Although New Zealand's initial involvement was in the East by early 1916, its centre of wartime operations had shifted from Egypt to Europe. The shock of Gallipoli was to pass into the unrelieved attrition of trench warfare on the Western Front, and this is where the majority of New Zealand troops would serve. Consequently, military infrastructure came to be concentrated around London. Military headquarters and hospitals were based there, and the main New Zealand camp, Sling, was just 74 miles away on the Salisbury Plains. Now, this led to a singular cultural experience that has been little considered in New Zealand or metropolitan histories of war's effects. In 1 4-year period, thousands of New Zealand soldiers, most of whom had never been overseas before, found themselves in the imperial capital. Now, exactly how many arrived is unknown, but this was no minor cultural phenomenon. The New Zealand Soldiers Club, which was just around the corner from here, was one of several clubs that the soldiers could choose from to stay in, and they served 250,000 meals and recorded 67,483 bed nights in 1918 alone. Nor was this experience unacknowledged at the time. In a kind of sardonic salute to the Prime Minister of the day, the members of New Zealand's largest ever travelling party referred to themselves as Bill Massey's tourists. Whether on leave from Sling, on leave from France, on leave from hospital, these soldier tourists found their way to what they called the Big Smoke. Herbert Green, our photographer, managed all three routes in. He had his first taste of home when he arrived at Sling Camp in 1917. After being sent to France, he was given leave in 1918, which he spent in London. And he returned again in early 1919, this time as a patient at the Walton-on-Thames Hospital. On his release, he stayed in London, joining the New Zealand Military Records Office. Here he is with his... I'm not sure which one he is. At the records office, he was capitalising on his professional background as a photographer for the Littleton Times. When he was off duty, he also continued to take pictures. Now, some of these photographs are the sorts of things we would expect from war. But Herbert Green's war, like that of so many others, included the metropolis, and his images captured some of its attractions. Busy streets, historic sites, famous parks. Now, Green's skill as a photographer, when you work through his album, is obvious, but the experiences he captured are not really exceptional. They were recorded by others in diaries, in letters, in postcards, in books of views, and most of all, in their memories. For these were stories from the war that certainly could be told. Yet, these experiences and their impact on New Zealand's culture and identity have not been typical in our histories. War, especially World War I, has become almost inextricably linked with narratives of an independent national identity, and we talked about some of those yesterday. In numerous histories, the deadly shores of Gallipoli and the mud of the Western Front are not only scenes of staggering mortality, but of a kind of redemptive rebirth. Away from home and amongst the British, it has been claimed, soldiers found themselves to be something distinct. They had become New Zealanders. The argument runs that the disappointments of British military command, and even of British soldiers themselves, and the recognition that New Zealanders had distinctive characteristics, provided a platform for an emerging sense of nationality. Consequently, World War I has been conscripted into a larger story of a New Zealand identity formed by breaking old ties between New Zealand and the mother country. But war could forge ties as well as break them. And the experiences of New Zealand soldiers meant that, in this case, the ties were reinvented in some very specific ways. The scale and the location of war meant that New Zealand's old home had to stand in for the new one when New Zealand soldiers went on leave. As an official history recounted, Britain was the New Zealanders' place of respite from the horrors of war, and as such it will always be remembered as a halfway home, or, as the undemonstrative New Zealander sometimes describes it, a home away from home. However, making a home away from home in London for thousands of soldiers did not rely on the sentiment and nostalgia that these terms evoke. Instead, I'm going to argue today that the metropolis was actively and deliberately reconstructed as home in two linked ways. First, parts of London were physically transformed into New Zealand space in order to provide the infrastructure for the New Zealand occupation of London. And this physical reconfiguration was accompanied by another, more subtle recontouring of London as home. As the soldier tourists descended upon the Big Smoke, it became apparent that they needed somewhere more than just a place to stay. Some of the social and cultural controls of home also needed to be reinstated. To do this, the military turned for assistance to volunteer organisations. At a time when volunteerism was gendered and closely associated with maternalism and domesticity, as a result, Bill Massey's tourists experienced London configured as home in another sense. And you may not be able to read that, but that's a strand. It's a soldier's social centre. It says, you cannot spend any money here. It is your home. Come right in. So there's a lot of rhetoric around the idea of making them at home. Right. Of course, the official reconstruction of the metropolis as a home for New Zealanders was made considerably easier by the existing imaginative presence of London in New Zealand's culture. As imperial centre, London had always held an important cultural role, but towards the end of the 19th century, the relationship was both reconfigured and intensified as part of the process that Jamie described in his opening lecture, which he terms recolonisation. So, new communications technologies like steam, cable, cheap mass printing, sound recording, film, along with that tightened economic connection, overlaid older migration-based links to draw metropolis and colony closer together. One impact of this reinvigorated cultural relationship was to give New Zealanders a stronger sense of connection to the metropolis. Images created by newspapers, magazines, film and photography kept a version of London alive on the periphery. They made the metropolis familiar for people who hadn't even been there. And in fact, on arriving in Britain, one Gallipoli veteran noted that everything English bears the same air of familiarity, due beyond question to the thoroughness with which her life is portrayed in her novels. Now, it's possible that this lure of imagined England helped with recruiting. Certainly in the Australian case, travel was thought to have helped. In any case, the first recruits in the rush of 1914 were expecting to go to England. One soldier wrote from on board ship on the 25th of November 1914, "We're looking forward to a good Christmas dinner in England." So there was some disappointment when they were offloaded in Egypt instead. The pyramids might have been fine for these soldier tourists, but it was London, not Cairo, that the soldiers had really wanted to see. Later, when long casualty lists dispatched the idea of war as a great adventure, travel remained, if no longer an incentive, at least a bonus for serving. And home held the greatest attraction. Recruits serving on the Western Front had the option of leave in London or in Paris, and they voted with their feet. 10 men went to England on leave for every one that stayed in France. One veteran wrote to his wife from hospital in Brockenhurst, "I've had a good trip around France, although I was not able to see much of the places. However, I called that, and some of the words are illegible, possibly Rouen, Groisville, and Le Havre. And as nice as these places are, there are none equal to Blighty." Now, when soldiers did make it to England, London was the principal destination. Charles Sprague, arriving in 1915, caught the mood. "The impressions of England were all thrilling to us, to be in the old country. In due course, we were given leave to go where we liked and back pay too, so we all made for London." Soldiers encamped at Sling could expect draft leave. Oops, where's the... Here we are. That's the piece of paper they were very unlikely to stick it up the sergeant's arse. They really wanted these pieces. Like Sprague, most of them made for London. Captain Herbert King, part of the 2nd Otago Battalion, arrived in Sling on the 30th of October 1916 and was off to London just a few days later. Leave for Friday and Saturday was granted and everyone was taken to London. Realities of life in camp you know, in the official records, even Sling is referred to as unloved, made London even more attractive. A perpetual call to the exile and training. The perpetual call led to perpetual leave extensions. On the 13th of November 1916, that same Captain King wrote, I had exactly 14 days in England, but managed to spend six of those in London and saw a bit of the great city. Oops, let's go back one. There we go. That's sort of a cartoon of a digger's 14-day leave. Gives you a sense of the kind of things they're doing. Owen Clark reported to the army police in London whilst on leave and asked for an extension of 3 days, as some of my leave had been spoiled by a touch of the flu. Some didn't even bother with an excuse. Came to London, had a roam around, viewed inside St Paul's Cathedral, a very fine building, due back in camp, but overstayed a day or two. Now, when they arrived, these soldiers brought their imagined London with them, and this too may have helped make them feel more at home there than other places they visited. George Knight, writing from Boulogne, where he was wounded, said, oh, I hope I can see something of it. I'm longing to see Nelson's Monument, the Abbey, the Zoo, and the gardens. These are the chief things that have fixed themselves in my mind for London. Indeed, touring soldiers became masters of a kind of casual familiarity with the capital. In their writings, they roam about, knock about, potter about, and in one case even had a good old loaf around the heart of the empire. Ella Cook spent a few days piloting Nurse Eddie around. She thought, I found my way around splendidly. Really, I have never had much difficulty. We can always ask a policeman. Some could even afford to be unimpressed. Henry Gill was disappointed with London. I thought it would take an hour to cross the streets here, but I have seen as much traffic in Wellington, if not more. Was in the busy streets last night, the Strand and so forth, and I did not see any difference from Wellington. Mm. So, you know, in a couple of lines, Gill manages to kind of cut the imperial capital down to a manageable size. Not much harder to manage than Wellington, really. Now, part of feeling at home was also a function of race. Just being in London confirmed the privileged status of white New Zealanders within empire. Because white and non-white troops had fundamentally different experiences of the capital. Both could be considered spectacles of empire. Let's just hop forward, there we go. That's actually Thomas Scales' photo. So yesterday some of the art historian was talking about some of the official war photography. So one of the fascinating things is they're not that tall when you look at the photograph, despite legend. Okay. Both could be considered spectacles of empire, but in the case of white colonial soldiers, metropolitan attention enhanced the special status of the dominions. White soldiers were treated as archetypes of imperial manhood, irreproachably masculine, endorsing already existing beliefs that New Zealanders were, of course, of a superior stock. As metropolitan citizens, perhaps even superior ones, they were relatively, and in fact given their actual behaviour surprisingly, free from constraints while on leave in London. Wounded New Zealand soldiers, dressed in distinctive blue uniforms, were feted with special trips organised for them. One recalled an outing to the Eccentric Club, where they were placed at small tables, seating four only, two blue boys to a table, and something feminine opposite. The club members did all the waiting. Now, the blue uniforms did constitute a form of social control. They were intended to restrict some of the soldiers' activities. In particular, it prevented them from entering public bars. But similar arrangements for non-white soldiers were unthinkable. Non-white troops in the metropolis were monitored, as racial anxieties usually reserved for the periphery were transferred to the centre. Indians were closely supervised on Western soil, and never more so than in Britain. With even wounded Indian soldiers restricted to the grounds of hospitals rather than being given leave. Now, these rules would be based on fears of miscegenation and its attendant subversion of imperial order. According to one historian, if a rumour circulated that an Indian battalion was to be housed in a camp close to the residential quarters of British women munitions workers, protests were strenuous. So, while New Zealand troops could roam and loaf about the heart of empire, Indian soldiers were allowed only supervised access to the metropolis. in specially created Hindu or Muslim cook's tours that might include an hour's supervised shopping. Only some colonial soldiers, it seems, can be truly at home in the heart of empire. Now, while race and its relation to empire was a confounding problem for the military during World War I, it was not the only one to be managed. War, by its very nature, upset conventional social relationships and the conventional social controls they enforced. In the New Zealand main body, 56% of soldiers were under 25, and 85% were under 30. As one noted to a soldier, city life is like champagne, and they drank to the full in London's theatres, restaurants, and bars. This was particularly so for those soldiers on leave from the front. "Jack and I are on leave," wrote one soldier, "and you can understand it is like 14 days in paradise after being over in France 13 months. And I may tell you that we are living every hour of that 14 days. Now, sex was, along with drunkenness and gambling, considered part of city life. Dominion soldiers were described as strolling around London, hands in pockets, cigarettes in mouths, woman on arm, effective bachelors for the duration. Officers were not immune either, although apparently they stuck to the West End, went to women recommended by friends, and paid £5 for the night." This is another of Ring's photographs. So, Bill Massey's tourists then could be a little too familiar with the capital. In Egypt, officials responded to such behaviour by attempting to curb the soldiers. General Godley marched men through the red light district by day, hoping that a daylight look at the woman would put them off. After rioting, Cairo was put out of bounds, an extraordinarily mild punishment given the destruction involved. But though the Minister of Defence, Sir James Allen, claimed he would rather go through Egypt and all its wazzes than through London's streets, New Zealand soldiers' access to the heart of empire was unrestricted. As one officer observed, "London is crowded and very, very wicked." So, here's where we start to look at how there's an official attempt to construct a homely London in these circumstances. The job of domesticating wicked London for the soldier tourist was taken up by two volunteer organisations. Together, they initiated programmes designed to counterbalance the darker side of the metropolis with a more homely version. Now, clubs, and this is a map of some of the clubs, were the key physical location and manifestation of New Zealand's home in London. 79 clubs open to soldiers were listed in the Overseas Club Map and Guide, and they're all integrated into the, sort of the iconic geography of central London. Now, a number of these were defined by certain brands of soldier: Canadian, South African, officer, even colonial. The YMCA's Shakespeare Hut and the New Zealand Soldiers Club, which was the New Zealand War Contingent Association's residential club, marked the specifically New Zealand soldiers' metropolitan presence. So these venues are clustered around Russell Square, also the location of New Zealand's Military High Commission at 8 Southampton Row. Shakespeare Hut was in Keppel Street, so just up the road, on the corner of Russell Square, and the War Contingent Association Residential Club was there too, around the corner from its club rooms in Southampton Row. They were handy to Simpson and Edwards, the New Zealand military outfitters at number 98, if you needed replacement uniform buttons, for example, and straight line from here, as you can see, to the Strand, where the High Commission, New Zealand High Commission, was located, and the Australian YMCA hut, Aldwych, which was also very popular with New Zealanders. So we've got a New Zealand neighbourhood located in the heart of the. Now, within this neighbourhood, soldiers would find clubs fashioned as homes. Okay, that's what the Southampton Row one looked like. In one sense, this was implicit in their function, for clubs provided meals and accommodation. But homeliness was also reflected in the nature of contemporary volunteer work. At the turn of the century, this was women's work, and its emphasis on maternalism and domesticity leveraged women's private roles into the public sphere. war created greater scope for this work and emphasised these values. New Zealand Soldiers Clubs were staffed by women, oops, somewhere, we'll find it later, which increased the home-like atmosphere and acted as a reminder of family left behind in New Zealand. But these women were given a greater significance. Like the soldiers, they too were created as stereotypes, as archetypes. Cooking, cleaning, and helping the soldiers, they were mothers in the metropolis. Women at the New Zealand Soldiers Club were, it was claimed, only too pleased to do anything they could for the boys in the mending and darning line. Lucky are we boys from New Zealand. We are fairly what I might term carried about. We seem to have most of the good things going. In fact, the club is, I've often heard it termed, a regular home away from home. Clubs were presented then as familiar places with comforts of home and its conventions too. Within the club setting, soldiers engaged in the world's bloodiest war became boys to be looked after by women who were characterised as motherly. The YMCA referred to Shakespeare Hut, this is Shakespeare Hut here with some New Zealand soldiers around the front, as the New Zealanders' home away from home, and the success of the War Contingent Association clubs was put down to the homely atmosphere caused by the presence of New Zealand ladies among the boys. Now, this maternal archetype had a didactic purpose in the metropolis. It was set against its obverse, the prostitute. Both the public and the military were anxious about the sexual behaviour of soldiers, concern that was warranted given the high rates of venereal disease amongst the troops. However, fear of being seen to condone immorality prevented officials from doing anything particularly effective to prevent its spread. The New Zealand YMCA, for example, approached the problem of metropolitan temptation with a letter to soldiers. Its vuncular tone occasionally slips into the slightly hysterical, revealing the great anxiety felt about soldiers loose in London. But it also suggests that soldiers were not responsible for their own behaviour. Instead, they were victims, both of the effects of life on the front and the depredations of London's disreputable women. No doubt, a portion of your leave will be spent in the metropolis of empire, London. In this city, a soldier, particularly a colonial soldier, is up against a set of conditions such as he has never faced before. Unfortunately, London swarms with women, many of them hopelessly diseased, who live by trading what we have been taught to regard as women's most sacred possession. It is good advice to avoid these women, but difficult to follow when the matter has to be decided on the streets of London. Somehow or another, the reaction after life in France seems to render reason and self-control ineffective. Now, Philippa Levine has suggested that these sentiments struck a chord in the popular imagination, strengthening the opposition between moral innocence and depraved knowledge, and perhaps hinting that the white settler required a little longer the protection of the mother country. The New Zealand High Commissioner Sir Thomas Mackenzie saw it differently. Britain needed to curb its predatory women, and he urged the British government to segregate infected prostitutes to preserve our men, reconstructing the innocent and archetypal Dominion soldier by relocating the blame within the metropolis. The officer responsible for the New Zealand division in Britain coyly agreed military men had to be protected from the results of indulgence. So, having framed the problem as between innocent boys and evil sirens of the city, making a home staffed with archetypes of womanhood becomes a more comprehensible, if not particularly useful, attempt at control. At Shakespeare Hut's canteen, which seated 200, the soldiers were waited on by lady workers in their crushed strawberry-coloured frocks. And it should have always been a comfort to the mothers, wives, and sisters of the soldiers to know that such an enticing home was provided in the midst of London, with its temptations and its great loneliness. Now, there is some evidence to suggest that amongst the official vilification of metropolitan women and the imposition of maternal archetypes, the soldiers themselves viewed sex at home differently from other places. The infamous riot in Cairo's Red Light District was said to have been caused by accumulated contempt for the Egyptians themselves. One soldier on arriving in Britain wrote, "Most of us had got such a thorough sickening of the importunities of the filthy Arabs and Egyptians that it was a very welcome relief to find ourselves again in the company of nice girls." nice girls in this role could still be prostitutes. And some actually took on quite a domestic role with the soldiers, washing clothes, providing meals, and offering companionship, as well as sex during a soldier's leave. Now, this, of course, was not exactly the kind of domesticity that the volunteer organisations were wanting to construct. Both the YMCA's International Hospitality League and the New Zealand War Contingent Association had programmes to introduce New Zealand soldiers to the British through dinner invitations and visits to private homes and for longer home stays. Now, the YMCA claimed thousands of introductions of this type were made, although the War Contingent Association noted that guests could be in short supply. The main obstacle being the New Zealanders' aversion to making appointments to go to a stranger's house at such and such a time. He is afflicted with a natural shyness and a certain unwillingness to tie himself down to times and places, a shyness apparently lacking at other times on the streets of London. So falling into this official line, the chronicles describe these visits as the best sort of hospitality, and through it many friendships will spring up between old country folk and us across the seas. Now, some of these visits do actually revitalise family links, as New Zealand soldiers often use part of their leave to make connection with family and friends elsewhere in England. Reflecting this dual sense of propinquity in the New Zealand metropolitan relationship, Gordon Harper wrote to his mother, "The likeness between you and Aunt Fanny is wonderful in all sorts of ways. So you can understand what a great thing it is to come across such beautiful associations with our whole life at the other end of the world." So this was more the sense of home and family that volunteer organisations were working to create. Similarly, soldiers' access to undesirable types of homes was actively prescribed. Both volunteer organisations met the soldiers at train stations when they came on leave to avoid the activities of well-dressed people who meet these trains and did their utmost to induce the men to accept the hospitality of those homes, mostly dens of iniquity, which had sprung up in London. The International Hospitality League, concerned that hospitality could be carried too far, organised street patrols in action between 7 p.m. and 2 a.m. One of a number of similar schemes, their work was of a delicate personal nature, requiring the utmost tact to separate men from women of known disreputable character. Its success was so distinct that before long, Great Britain, Canada, the United States, Australia and New Zealand were engaged in it. So once again, it's unruly London with its disreputable women that was to be policed. New Zealand women, and here we have two of them, were members of the patrol, which came complete with its own uniform and sticks for the business of delicate separation. So that's Hugh and Ballantyne. There is actually some footage of them in operation on the Ta'ara website. It's said it's a Canadian film, but the women involved are these two New Zealanders who go on to continue to police social hygiene when they get back to New Zealand. Okay, so the creation of homely clubs and home visiting with its counterpart in guidebook configurations of the metropolis as a familiar space. The New Zealand YMCA published both The Soldier's Guide to the British Isles and Blighty to make soldiers feel at home in the old country. The Soldier's Guide made this clear. We know of no better means of maintaining the bonds of empire than for the children of empire to be familiar with the scenes and historic incidents of the great motherland. So in this case, disreputable London is to be overlaid with its historic and heritage version. And soldiers were once again transformed into children of empire, this time for the purposes of learning. London was the principal site, and soldiers had a duty to go and see it. But once they had, the guidebook urged them away. If you have not seen the capital of the empire, make the most of your first few days in seeing the chief places of interest, then get away to your friends in the country or wherever they may be. So volunteer organisations did not leave the important business of presenting London to guidebooks. The International Hospitality League opened booths all over London to provide information to soldiers so they could obtain reliable information instead of appealing to strangers who might or might not have been reliable. And both organisations ran escorted tours. This is what was known, rather unusually now, perhaps as a drag tour. So, there they get taken around. Now, they often used London gentlemen who acted as honorary guides, and thousands of New Zealand soldiers were shown around at no cost to themselves. Four of us went with guide Mr. Bernays, M.A., to see London sights. We saw through Royal Exchange, Guildhall, Library and Art Gallery attached, St. Lawrence Jewellery, Bow Church, Boyapenga Alley, Paternoster Row, Stationery Hall. This was historic and respectable London on show, a cultural prophylactic against the temptations of the metropolis. Such tours could be difficult to avoid. We were walking around when a YMCA manager seized hold of us and put a guard in charge of us. So, with a YMCA guide and a wandering soldier, we return to the unexpected. Conventionally, war's role in New Zealand's cultural history has been to break those bonds of empire. But the experiences of Bill Massey's tourists could also help reconstruct those bonds. Here they are admiring a statue of Havelock, the hero of the Indian Mutiny. War brought them to the heart of empire, a place already vivid in their imagination. Once there, an unlikely conjunction of war contingent workers, gentlemen guides, and nice British girls worked to transform the imperial metropolis into a familiar place for thousands of New Zealand soldiers. And I think this should also transform our understanding of the Great War's role in our past, away from a simplistic reading of nationhood and towards one that captures the more complex relationship between New Zealand and its metropolitan centre. For, as they roamed between London's heritage and its history and its wicked, wicked ways, Bill Massey's tourists managed to find themselves a home away from home.
Thank you very much, Felicity. Yes, so if we just have those lights. And we're just going to hold questions until the end of the session and have questions together. So if you can just hold on to your comments and questions for Felicity until the end of the session. So turning from Bill Massey's tourists to somebody who was very much unwillingly not a tourist in this side of the world. Rod's going to address us on "It's Your Submission We Want, Baxter, Archibald Baxter's We Will Not Cease." And I kept on reading this title, Rod, thinking of the two forms of submission that was being demanded of Baxter. We want your manuscript. We want your compliance. So I wasn't quite sure if that was deliberately in there.
Not at all. Yes, Archibald Baxter was a rather different kind of Massey tourist, one that was, as Charlotte says, quite unwilling. New Zealand introduced conscription in August 1916, Parliament standing and singing the national anthem as the Military Service Act was passed. Early the following year, Archibald Baxter, an Otago farmer and father of the poet James K. Baxter, was detained for refusing to enlist, taken to Trentham Military Camp in Wellington, and after refusing to obey an order to scrub the corridor outside the cell where he was held, was court-martialed and sentenced to 84 days hard labour. At the end of his sentence, and after once again refusing to obey an order, he and 13 others, including his brothers Jack and Sandy, were marched to the wharves and taken aboard the military transport ship Waitemata. They had no warning of this and no opportunity to let family or friends know of their forced transportation to Britain and the front line. Baxter landed in Plymouth on Boxing Day 1917 and was taken to Sling on Salisbury Plain. He was held here for some weeks, handcuffed so that he wouldn't remove the uniform he'd been forced to wear, while the military authorities tried to break down his resistance. Failing to do so, they had Baxter taken to Belgium and subjected to number one field punishment, a form of torture in which the victim was tied by his ankles, knees and wrists to a large willow stump inclined forward out of the perpendicular and left exposed to the elements and the shelling. Baxter described how the forward slope of the post shifted all his weight onto his arms, and how, with the ground at the base of the pole worn away, he could get no grip with his feet. The rope around his wrist was tied so tight that the circulation to his hands was cut off, leaving them black with congested blood when the daily spells of 2 or 3 hours, morning and afternoon, were over. This torture persisted over the bitter winter months of February and March 1918. Following this period, Baxter was subjected to physical assault, deprived of food, threatened with being shot, and forcibly taken to the front line. En route to the Somme, under heavy shell fire, Baxter became separated from the main body of men, collapsed from exhaustion and starvation, and was eventually found, as he put it, half conscious and without thought, dressed only in his socks and underwear. After brief recuperation in a military hospital in Boulogne, where his weight was recorded as 7.5 stone, 4 stone lighter than normal, he was returned to England and held for some months in a hospital for mentally disturbed soldiers, before being returned to Wellington at the end of the war. His account of these experiences, I'll get his account of these experiences, We Will Not Cease, was written in 1937, although some of the material derived from notes dictated to his wife, Millicent Brown, soon after the end of the war. Baxter had returned to Europe in 1937 to attend the War Resisters International Conference in Copenhagen, and most of the book was actually written in Salisbury, near where he'd been held in sling 20 years earlier. The war years themselves had produced poetry rather than prose. Sassoon, Owen, Rosenberg, the roll call is familiar, and Harry spoke about it yesterday. And sustained prose writing about the experience, whether memoir, fiction, or drama, often took a decade or more to incubate. Edmund Blunden's Undertones of War was published in 1928, and Robert Graves's Goodbye to All That the following year, Remarque's novel All Quiet on the Western Front, and Richard Aldington's Death of a Hero were both published in 1929. R.C. Sheriff's play Journey's End, with a young Olivia playing on the London stage, had a 2-year West End run in 1928-1929. It's being revived all over the place at present. It's being revived by a local Amdram society just down the road from where I live in Kent. The second, Ford Madox Ford's tetralogy, Parade's End, began to appear in 1925, and perhaps helped break the banks for the flood of prose writing about the war that followed in the late 1920s and into the early 30s. The reasons for this delayed reaction are not difficult to imagine. The experience itself was so traumatic that any narrative representation or reflective evaluation of it took years to shape. Writing itself must often have seemed impossible or pointless. Baxter, held in the grim asylum of Bradmore Hospital after being returned to England, couldn't even send a letter home. "I found it impossible to write," he said. And after his return home, the most he could do, it seems, was to dictate notes to Millicent. I imagine he knew Goodbye to All That. Graves is the more sophisticated writer, but his spare, understated prose provides a model for writing about extremity and horror that Baxter might well have learnt from. Even the vernacular four-word titles of both works, Goodbye to All That, We Will Not Cease, seem to echo each other, I'm speculating. But it is, I think, clear that Baxter's return to Europe, his residence in Salisbury, and the shadow of a Second World War released the memories and provided the stimulus and urgency necessary for the writing of his memoir. We Will Not Cease had an unfortunate publishing history. It was brought out in England in 1939 by Victor Gallants, and very few copies had reached New Zealand before the outbreak of World War II. All the unsold copies held by the publisher were destroyed in the Blitz in 1941, and it remained unpublished in New Zealand until the Caxton Press brought it out in 1968. One of the books that I most mourn losing was a Caxton Press, the Caxton Press reissue, republication of We Will Not Cease in 1968. I must have given it to someone. That's a thing with books that you love. You press them on someone else and they never come back. So I have the Catley Press edition that was reprinted many years later. I don't know who initiated the republication of We Will Not Cease in 1968, but the timing surely wasn't accidental. In his foreword to the Caxton Press edition, Baxter, still alive, makes explicit reference to the Vietnam War, and in particular the fact that 80% of its casualties were civilian, and he wrote in the introduction, "War has at last become wholly indiscriminate. The military machine is turned against that communal life which is the seedbed of future generations." New Zealand, of course, had troops in Vietnam, and visits from General Maxwell Taylor and Lyndon Johnson in the late 1960s upped the pressure to commit more. Australia had sent conscripts to Vietnam, and when I was called up in 1967 to train for the army, I registered as a conscientious objector. We Will Not Cease was republished a few months after I'd gone before the tribunal, and I found it more sustaining than I can easily describe. So I want to turn to the work itself as a literary text, for the experience it records, and for what it might tell us of attitudes to dissent in New Zealand. I've already made brief mention of its plain documentary style, itself a carefully achieved literary effect rather than just an unconsidered way of writing. The tone throughout is matter of fact. There is no outrage or explicit condemnation of his treatment. There is only a limited degree of introspection, pretty much confined to his growing realization that the authorities would never let up in their efforts to break his will. This meant, as he came to realize, and as he put it, a fight to the finish. The focus of the book is remorselessly on what is happening to him. He doesn't think of home, he loses contact with his brothers early on, and they hardly figure in the story. In its first-person matter-of-factness, it reminds me of the reportage that was a feature of much writing in the 1930s, Orwell's, for example. But very differently, it also reminds me of John Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress, a work that has, of course, begun in prison. Baxter's story is also that of a pilgrim, a journey through the valley of the shadow of death towards the celestial city and the vision of a world without war. The Pilgrim's Progress and We Will Not Cease are both works of militant Puritanism, each dramatizing the lonely integrity of the man who refuses to conform and submit. Again, I'm guessing, but I think it very likely that Baxter knew The Pilgrim's Progress. He had relatively little schooling, but was widely read. In an early poem, To My Father, James K. Baxter lists his recollections of Archibald, among them being the lines, "You quoting Burns and Byron while I listened." In the same poem, James K. describes his father as, again quoting from the poem, "a poet whom the time betrayed to action." And there is, of course, the title of Baxter's memoir, From Blake's Jerusalem, or actually, more correctly, from the preface to Blake's long poem, Milton. Blake never titled that poem Jerusalem, and would have been astonished to see the way in which it's become a kind of substitute national anthem for the British, for the English particularly, and the way in which promenaders on the second to last night of the proms, with cheery smiles, sing of those dark satanic mills, would have left them quite gobsmacked. The line "we will not cease," of course, continues from Mental Fight. And for all the physical violence that Baxter suffered, his stand was above all a mental fight. We Will Not Cease has many characteristics of the prison and the Holocaust memoir. Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon, for example, or even Primo Levi's This Is a Man. Levi insisted that the Nazi concentration camps were the extreme end of a continuum rather than a horror without precedent or comparison. As he wrote, "In every part of the world, wherever you begin by denying the fundamental liberties of mankind and equality among people, you move towards the concentration camp system." And of course, the idea of the concentration camp was the isolation and execration of a targeted and stigmatized group, which is precisely how conscientious objectors were seen and treated. I'll now cut to the chase and look more closely at the work itself. Returning to it after many years, I was struck by its proportioning, by how much space it gives to his detention in New Zealand. I'd remembered vividly his months in England at the front, but forgotten that at least a third of the book deals with his time in the jail on the terrace in Wellington, where, for example, there are men serving 14-year sentences for their homosexuality. Another prisoner whose legs are shriveled and atrophied is denied his wheelchair and forced to drag himself round on his hands and feet. The effect of this is to emphasize some of the continuities, some of the similarities between his incarceration in Wellington and his treatment at the front. A recurring theme of the first half of the book is the contest over uniform. Clothes, of course, are personally expressive, and the point of clothing soldiers in uniform is to take away their individuality, to render them cogs in what Baxter always calls the military machine. When the 14 objectors on board the Waitemata refuse to put on uniform, they are taken from their jail in the hold, brought out on deck where the soldiers on board had been gathered. They're stripped and forcibly dressed in uniform, and their hair is cropped. Back in the hold, they take off the uniform. This contest intensifies at Sling, where Baxter is kept in handcuffs, which are removed only when he's asleep and while eating, in order to make sure he stays in uniform. In the end, when he's about to be taken from Sling to the front, he concedes, I quote, he concedes the issue of uniform, and he writes, "I should be compelled to wear it, whether I refused or not. Would it not be better to use all my strength in concentrating on the main point, the refusal to perform any military service? They could not compel me to do that without my consent." End of quote. Baxter apologizes to the reader for his capitulation over uniform, but actually I don't think he gave in at all. The state in which he was found somewhere on the way to the Somme, dressed only in his socks and underwear, was, I think, his most telling resistance to wearing uniform. As he floundered along, falling into ditches, shells exploding around him, before subsiding half-conscious and near death at the edge of a bomb crater, he must at some point, and without consciously knowing what he did, have taken off his uniform. Baxter's resistance went very deep. The authorities, both civil and military, couldn't compel his consent, but the lengths to which they went in trying were extraordinary. Perhaps the most wearing was verbal. This was particularly intense during his time at Sling. A succession of army chaplains played soft cop, echoing Worldly Wiseman's attempt in the Pilgrim's Progress to convince Christian he'll save himself a lot of trouble by paying lip service and giving in. Baxter remarks to these chaplains and padres, and I quote, "In peacetime they preach, thou shalt not kill, and love your enemies and all that. Hear the echo of praise? And all that. And when a nation goes to war, what happens to them? End of quote. Hardcop was Colonel Howard. We'll make your life a hell, Baxter, he says. To which Baxter responds that although they can certainly make him suffer, only he himself can make his own life a hell. By the time he reaches the front, Baxter is, as he puts it, utterly disinclined for argument. One morning, after refusing an order and being repeatedly knocked to the ground with punches to the jaw, he is taken before a Captain Phillips, and yet again obliged to explain and defend his stand. It is from here that I take the title of my paper. Phillips tells Baxter they have received, in quotes, very harsh instructions from New Zealand about how he should be treated. Baxter then asks what good he would be to the authorities if he was broken, and is told, it's your submission we want, Baxter, not your services. End of quote. Phillips warns him that if he continues to resist, he will never leave the front alive, and soon after, he is threatened with being shot for once again refusing an order. The never-ending attempts to persuade Baxter he's wrong, to catch him out in some inconsistency, this alternation of verbal interrogation with physical violence never lets up. At Bradmore, the hospital for mentally disturbed soldiers, where he is held after his return to England, is compelled to defend his position to the medical officer, who then lectures him on the law of the fittest. In the closing scene of the book, after his return to New Zealand, he is interrogated by a medical board at Dunedin Hospital and abused by its chairman. What are you? Thundered the man. A man, what do you take me for? I replied. Then a torrent of angry words was let loose on me. Baxter tries to leave the room and is seized by orderlies and dragged back to his interrogation. The war is over, Baxter is home, but the persecution continues. In the final paragraph of the book, he is informed that he must now report regularly to the police. Homecoming brings no relief. We will not cease, does not leave us with a sense of Baxter having overcome, but instead with just a solitary individual confronting a system that still cannot tolerate his conscientious objection. His experience has come full circle, and we're back at the opening of the book when two policemen come to his farm and take him away in a cart. Like other conscientious objectors, Baxter was deprived of his civil rights for the next 10 years. Throughout the war, and for years afterwards, these men inhabited a no-man's land in which, as Baxter puts it, they had the rights neither of a soldier nor of a civilian. Why these extraordinary lengths to compel the submission of one man? In 1915, a national register was taken in which all men of military age were required to state whether they were willing to undertake military service. Of the approximately 196,000 men in this category, 33,000 said they wouldn't undertake service at home or abroad, and a further 44,000 were only willing to undertake home service. Together, well over a third of the total that had submitted a reply to the register. In other words, it seems to me there was at that point in the war, there was a far from ready acquiescence to turn out for king and country. An intensive recruitment campaign followed. James Gibb, a leading Presbyterian minister and a friend of Prime Minister Massey, who was himself a Presbyterian, preached a widely publicised sermon in Christchurch, which was the main centre of the peace movement in New Zealand. In it, Gibbs said, and this was given much publicity, it is the urgent duty of all men of age and physical fitness to offer themselves at once to their country, and it is the duty of all women to surrender their man, nay, to bring pressure on them to do their duty to the flag. Even so, it took the introduction of conscription in August 1916 to ensure that New Zealand really did its bit. In deciding what to do with those who continued to object, a distinction was made between secular and socialist objectors on one hand, people like Peter Fraser, later Prime Minister, Robert Semple, who was a cabinet minister in Fraser's cabinet. So you've got the secular and socialist objectors on one hand, and on the other, those whose objection was religiously based. By early 1917, Fraser, Semple, and a number of other prominent anti-conscriptionists, such as James Chappell, Maurice Gee's grandfather, and a model for the hero of his novel Plum, these men had been imprisoned. But a nominally Christian country, fighting what it saw as a godly war, had to tread a little carefully when dealing with resistance from institutionalized religions. Even so, the concession here was small, exemption only being granted to religious bodies like the Quakers and the Christadelphians, which explicitly declared military service contrary to divine revelation. Baxter's own position didn't quite fit these categories. He was a socialist, but not a prominent, or I think even an affiliated one, like Fraser or Chappell. He belonged to no organized church, but he objected to being registered as an agnostic when his details were taken at the terrorist prison. This was an issue in England as well. Bertrand Russell, in his autobiography, recalls that when he was taken into prison as a conscientious objector during the First World War, and his personal details are being taken by one of the warders, when he's asked his religion, Russell replies defiantly, atheist, to which the warder replies, "Well, we get some strange ones in here, but I guess we all believe in the same God." The longer statement of Baxter's religious position is when being interrogated by Colonel Simpson just before he begins his sentence of number one field punishment. And this is it. "I said I did not belong to any organized church, but that it seemed to me the teaching of Christ was entirely against war or taking any part in it. But even if that had not been so, I would still consider I was right in taking my present attitude." Baxter was ever resistant to being categorized in official terms. So political, social, and personal pressure, intensified by the introduction of conscription, reduced the number of those refusing to serve to a handful. No doubt it was felt that targeted and sustained pressure and the loss of personal freedom would break down the remaining few. But the political and military authorities came up against the principled obduracy of Baxter and his companions. Paul Baker in King and Country Call, which is certainly the first book-length study of conscientious objection in New Zealand, argues that the decision to transport the 14 was taken suddenly and solely on the initiative of the commander of Trentham Camp, because there happened to be spare room on the Waitemata. The Military Service Act certainly allowed for transportation, but I'm a bit sceptical of the claim that it was simply this, as it were, ad hoc decision of one man. But I have done no research to counter that. From then on, from this point on, in the case of Baxter and his extraordinary fellow objector, Marx Briggs at least, it was a matter of an irresistible force confronting an unmovable object. Mark Briggs, I was going to say at this point that Mark Briggs is someone who should be more written about, because he was the most absolutely thoroughgoing conscientious objector. He refused to wear uniform. When Baxter was escorted to the front each day, he walked. Mark Briggs refused to walk and was dragged across the duckboards, his thin uniform shredded by the boards, the wire, the nail. The wounds in his back were so deep that he very nearly died. He just simply hung on and hung on. I was going to say that it needs to be, and then Harry yesterday asked me a book that he has just co-edited, just out from Victoria University Press, called How We Remember, New Zealanders and the First World War. And in it is an essay on Mark Briggs by David Grant, who's also written elsewhere on Baxter and on conscientious objection. So, an irresistible force confronting an unmovable object. What can power do when faced with an implacable refusal to obey? I'm reminded of Herman Melville's remarkable story Bartleby, in which the eponymous anti-hero's passive but unbending response to all instructions, "I would prefer not to," reduces his employer to helplessness. The story ends in Bartleby's death from starvation, a fate that Baxter himself only narrowly escaped. As each effort by the military to compel Baxter's submission fails, the punishment increased in an inexorable logic of violence that is constrained, if at all, only by the awareness that if Baxter is killed, he'll become a martyr for his cause. Transportation to the front line and field punishment for conscientious objectors had been tried by the British Army for their conscientious objectors in 1916 and had failed. None of the 70 so treated gave in, and after strong public criticism at home, the policy had been abandoned. This must have been known to the New Zealand Defence Department, though Paul Baker found no mention of its failure in official records. But for New Zealanders, the home front was 12,000 miles away, not just across the channel. Distance, as always in imperial matters, played an important part, and so too did the secrecy around the transportation of the 14. Although a note smuggled off the Waitemata before it departed Wellington Harbour did lead to protests from Labour, women's and anti-militarist groups, this had no wider effect. Baker concludes that most New Zealanders were either unaware of the transportation or approved of it. Public concern was voiced in 1918 after the circulation of a letter from Baxter to his parents by the Christchurch writers and peace activists Blanche Bourne and Jesse Mackay. And the Minister of Defence, James Allen, whose name has rung through this conference, was sufficiently worried to visit the ship that brought Baxter home when it anchored in Wellington Harbour, and he was much relieved to find Baxter either reluctant or unable to say much at all. Harry Holland's account of Baxter's and others' experiences, Armageddon or Calvary, published in 1919, seems to have had little impact at all. No doubt the country was war-weary, but I doubt that was the only reason for the book's lack of impact. Intolerance of dissent and public acquiescence in its suppression seems to me a strong feature of national life in the first 50 or 60 years of the 20th century. In the Second World War, Britain and Australia were more tolerant in their treatment of conscientious objectors than New Zealand. Indeed, for the leaders of both those countries, Great Britain and Australia, the tolerance of dissent was an important marker of difference from Nazi Germany. Here's Neville Chamberlain. "It often happens that those who hold the most extreme opinions hold them with the greatest tenacity. We learned something about this in the Great War, and we found that it was both a useless and an exasperating waste of time and effort to attempt to force such people to act in a manner which was contrary to their principles." And here's Robert Menzies, that Cold War warrior and one of the architects of the White Australia policy. "The greatest tragedy that could overcome a country would be for it to fight a successful war in defence of liberty and lose its own in the process." And here's New Zealand's Labour Prime Minister, Michael Joseph Savage, an opponent of conscription in the First World War, whose deputy Peter Fraser and several of his cabinet colleagues had been imprisoned during that war for the conscientious objector, and he was awarded the title New Zealander of the Century by the New Zealand Herald in 1999. "Freedom such as we enjoy breeds the truest patriots, but its genial climate permits also the growth of cranks and ingrates, of dreamers of fantastic dreams, of ideological oddities and ne'er-do-wells, a diversity of creatures having this at least in common, the urge to propagate error. What was it, I wonder, that bred and permitted such attitudes?" something that's surfaced during this conference, I mean, highlighted by Charlotte's paper, but I was thinking about it again, listening to the paper about the Turkish perspective on Gallipoli yesterday afternoon, and that is the enormous importance of the relation of one war to another, of old wars to new wars. Just in putting this paper together, it's taken me from the First World War to the Second World War to Vietnam. I was reminded of Lenin's famous words. That's not John Lennon, the leader of the Russian Revolution. Where he described war as the locomotive of history, and I think that's an important idea for New Zealand history at this time. And that question of how a war is reconstructed by a successive war and rethought by a war following. Several people have raised the point about how Anzac Day ceremonies went into a dip in the 60s and I think into the 70s. Certainly in the 50s and early 60s at my secondary school, we were obliged to march in uniform on Anzac Day to the cenotaph, and one never thought of not doing so. 10 years later, this had really gone into abeyance, I think. And I think that is to do with primarily with the influence of the Vietnam War, with New Zealand's involvement in Vietnam, with a strong anti-war movement in New Zealand at the time. But I'd like to conclude, in the face of Savage's ugly rhetoric, peacefully, with James Kay's tender description of Archibald in old age, in the poem, To My Father in Spring, where he describes his father's smile as like a low sun on water, I think a moving and luminous simile. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. So, two wonderful papers, which we've got time for questions and comments.
Yes. My comments are for Felicity. First of all, I'd like to apologise for missing the start of your paper. Yes, I know it's horrible, but I really enjoyed it. My comments are two. The first one relates to your main argument that
yes.
The First World War actually tightened the bonds between New Zealand and the UK. I totally agree with that, and I think that argument has been made for the dominions of Australia and Canada as well to a large extent. And my other specific comment was about the spread of BD and the kind of reaction, the spread of BD amongst New Zealand soldiers and the official kind of response to that. It reminded me of my own research on Australia and the war, and it was a very similar response. You know, the soldiers were seen as innocent victims of these predatory women, and it was the women that needed to be separated. And what I was really shocked at was a memorandum saying they should actually be subject to medical examinations on the spot, which, you know, I think might have actually practiced, but yeah, it was quite shocking to me that, yeah. The men were, you know, were innocent victims who had self-control, and women needed to be controlled. So, yeah.
Yes, that's true. It's a very similar experience across Canada and Australia. I think Canada were the champions when they had the highest per capita rates of venereal disease during the war.
You don't know?
I'm pretty sure it's the Canadians that won that
not
one.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who won
we
the
were
BD
competition? We were competitive.
Did they have Eddie Rod?
Not to my knowledge, no. And interestingly enough, the two International Hospitality League women had started off with Eddie, but they diverged. She'd gone on to do her practical work and they stayed with their sticks.
In Jamie's lecture the other night when he talked about the mothers not having babies after the war, I was wondering whether it might also be the greater knowledge of contraceptives through her work.
Yes. And possibly
and
some of the results of venereal disease as well.
Yes.
Thanks. Just a question for Rod. Rod, do you know when it was that conscientious objectors in the First World War would have become socially rehabilitated, as it were? I mean, I'd guess the early 30s with the Labour government, but might it have been even earlier?
Yes, I'm not sure. I can only. I was reading the piece by David Grant about Mark Briggs last night, and I was rather tired. I can't quite remember where. Mark Briggs was living, but it was somewhere, I think, in the Wairarapa or the Manawatū.
Yes,
he'd regularly be visited by, I think, Peter Fraser, Bob Semple, you know, others would call call in. So I think certainly within that part of New Zealand sort of political society, he must have become a kind of quiet hero, and he does seem to have been a quiet man. But beyond that, I would suspect, I suppose the logic of my argument would be that they were never rehabilitated. This is why it was so easy for conscientious objectors to be treated more badly in the Second World War. I don't think in the years between the wars that there had been an acceptance or rehabilitation of them at all.
But actually Rod sort of half answered what I was going to ask or say. It's slightly anecdotal, but Millicent herself in her autobiography says that she actually went out of her way to meet Archibald Baxter because she'd heard of his exploits or whatever you described them. So clearly he did have some kind of name amongst certain people.
Yes.
And so that's how they met. She herself might even say in her autobiography what happened subsequently, because she's quite detailed about that kind of information. And my question to Felicity is, the hats that those two women are wearing, are they lemon squeezers?
They look as if they are. It's hard to tell because it's a really grainy.
Yeah, they've got
photo.
That slightly indented look.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have time to say yesterday in my talk that Malone was responsible for the lemon squeezer. I mean, he was the first person that punched his hat in to make it have those ridges. And it has been suggested that it was adopted more widely as a mark of respect to Malone.
Hmm.
So it'd be a nice irony to think that it might have, that mark might have drifted through to the
ended up crowning
that. He would have been in favour of their behaviour.
Oh,
surely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a fanatical hygienist. I didn't have time to mention that either. And he said, true battle starts on the domestic front. keeping it clean.
Yes, because I mean the whole question of where the International Hospitality League got the uniforms from is one that I don't know, but presumably they just used
they would have
what was around,
a male
just
one.
Adapted
oh, sure.
What was around.
That's
like
VADs.
I am mortified and ashamed of the way that Baxter was treated by New Zealand, and I do believe the Australians had an agreement with Britain that their troops could not be shot for desertion, whereas New Zealand had no such policy.
Oh.
And what happened to the 14? How many of them survived? I would like to know. But also to tell people that I was recently given a book. It's called Hornchurch and the New Zealand Connection. Hornchurch out of London, and I'll leave it on the table so people can have a look. It's about the New Zealand Connection and the First World War.
The remaining objectors kind of, I hate to use the word, I can't think of a better one, capitulated to some extent. There are different histories in each case, but a number of them became medical orderlies, for example. I mean, several of them were in poor health by the time they'd reached England. There's an interlude in South Africa that there was measles on board the White Armada. They're all taken off at Cape Town, some of them quite ill, and there's almost a little passage of pastoral for a book like this anyway, where Bax is down on the Cape and has about a month. He goes plant collecting and talks to fishermen and so on. It's not a depressing book to read, and it makes me angry and it moves me, but its spirit is extraordinary. But there are these other. It has light and shade as well. But the short answer is that that others gave into the pressure. And who can blame them?
I've got a uniform question for Felicity.
Okay.
Why do you suppose those seven or so handsome young dudes at Large and Hyde Park weren't wearing their Sam Brown belts?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? There's quite a variation in what they were wearing. And going through the album, I actually tried to use it to identify various people. I have no idea why they did that. It may well be that they simply lost buttons. The fact that you had to find new buttons, and because you notice one of them had no proper buttons either.
Mm.
So I don't know, but it's they were a good-looking bunch, like this terrific photo, you know.
Can I have a question for Rod too? Please, thank you. It seems really peculiar that a lot of the impetus for the treatment of conscientious objectors would be to encourage the others.
Would be
to encourage the others, you know, put into the terrible treatment to set an example for...
As a deterrent.
As a deterrent. But it seems, in that case, really incongruous that the 14 were kind of smuggled out under the cover of darkness, and probably, unless there were kind of resistance communities where Millicent got to find out about how people like that were being treated, that it was all under cover of secrecy, which makes me really wonder who's benefited to it for.
Well, I mean, you know, perhaps it is the case that the superintendent of Trentham Camp was just told he got people to put on board. And perhaps perhaps that just happened. I'm prone to conspiracy theory. As William Burroughs said, you know, Plummer's paranoid is simply somebody who doesn't know the full story, and that's what I. So, but yes, of course, and a lot of conscientious objectors in the First World War were detained in New Zealand. So, as you say, if this was going to be an example, then it kind of failed because it wasn't known about. So perhaps it was just improvised. And I do think it then became a kind of the sort of inexorable logic I talked about. I mean, I think everyone's caught up in that. It's a bit like sort of master-slave dialectic or something, that the more they refused, the more they had to do more to try and break their refusal. And but the, yeah, beyond that.
Yeah, I have a question for Felicity about the connection with Egypt and this letter. I think that was a letter that the soldier wrote about the filthy Arabs.
Yes.
Is that a letter, or is there a book that has this?
Where does it come from?
Yes.
It comes from Nicholas Boyack and Jane Tollerton's book. So I can give you the details of that later.
For Felicity, I've come late, so possibly the subject has come up, and if so, ignore it. But I came across somebody called Etty Rudd, I think she was called.
Sure.
And when I saw those two wonderful ladies of the Chastity Patrol, I thought you were going to mention her. Did you come across her in your research?
We did just mention her briefly. These two women originally left with Etty and worked with her in Egypt,
yeah.
But because she then gave up the kind of moral route, they preferred to stay working in that way and left Etty to do her own campaigning.
Mm.
Rod, and that is, what was the moral what was the legal background for depriving Baxter of his civil rights when the war had finished? What was the legal, how would they do it legally?
Could someone help me? Did the military?
I understand it's the basis of the national conditions of national service, and it applies also to prisoners. On ordinary crimes.
Prisoners, they have been convicted by a court and all that sort of stuff.
But Baxter's considered to have broken the law by not complying with the conditions of service or to fit into the accepted conditions of dissent.
So would this be covered under the Military Service Act?
Yes. So that's the basis of withdrawing.
He'd never been part of the army, had he?
No. But he hadn't been not a part of it legally either.
But they regarded him as part of the army. That was the whole point, you know.
So he had
been conscripted and he refused to conform. But he was subject to the Military Service Act.
But just taking up that point, Rod, and the one that was made a bit earlier, there has been some discussion in New Zealand in recent years, so over the last 5 to 10 years, about there being some form of public apology to the treatment given to Baxter and Briggs in particular. And that there has been, as some of you will know, what they call medallic grievances. Several soldiers who have been, by legislation,
awarded decorations for service during war, during World War One, for things which they, you know, should have been argued, should have been given medals for, and have been given so subsequently, like the last 10 years. So that's reward that they should have earned. And along with that, a sort of another discussion about whether some sort of official apology should be made and redress around this. And the responses have been quite divided about that.
Yes.
Yeah, so you know, people saying no, you know, Baxter was treated wrongly and it takes away his stance in order to if something was sort of conceded around it. Yeah. And other people arguing, yeah, well, yes, it was the kind of wrong that should be acknowledged. So it's a curious thing.
It's an ongoing story, isn't it? Because I'm aware that there was a film shown on New Zealand television sometime in the last few months that was based on this. And there's
a field of punishment.
And there's a feature film, I believe, that's under production or planned as well. So I think we'll probably hear a lot more of it in the next 3 or 4 years. Did anyone see this television film?
No, it's available on. You can find it very easily.
What was the name of it?
Field punishment.
Concentrating on Baxter. Now, Briggs is important. Concentrating on Baxter's story. Concentrated on Baxter's story, although Briggs was an important sort of, but he was given a sort of more subsidiary part.
And was it good?
Yeah, I thought so. No one of the actors, so you forced me to watch it. But the trouble with watching things on TV is that you have ads all the time.
It's a complex book, I think.
You can watch it on TV and see it on demand. I don't know if we can get you geographical access to it, but it's there.
Well, thank you very much, Felicity and Rob, for a wonderful session, and I think some of the points that you've picked up and the stories you've told us will continue to be in our minds during the day and time to come. So can you join me in thanking?